supported by listeners like yourselves. So 212-209-2950 is the number to call to show your support. That's 212-209-2950, or go to give to WBAI.org online. It is now 3 p.m. Stay tuned for Live on the Fly with Randy Credico coming up.
Okay, that was Anton Karas, The Third Man. I don't know why I have to say that every week. I'm Randy Credico. This is Randy Credico Live on the Fly here at WBAI 99.5 FM in New York City, WBAI.org. Give the number two, WBAI.org. We're in Brooklyn here with Reggie, and we have a packed show today. Later in this first half hour, we'll be joined by popular demand, Dmitry Polyansky, the ambassador to the UN from Russia Federation. We're going to go. I want to play a little bit of music here before we do that, Reggie. Set this up. This is music from Nicaragua, Carlos Mejia Godoy, just a pastiche of one of his many great tunes, anti-imperialism tunes from, I think, 84, 85. I spent a lot of time down there, and I know my first guest did as well, and that is the redoubtable Medea Benjamin, who has a couple of she has a great new book out, and she's written a lot of books. She is the ultimate peace activist and author, and she's wonderful. And she'll be right back on the show in just 1 minute. Okay, this is Carlos Mejia Godoy. Just a piece.
Hermano de viento, de canto y de luz, decime si en tus andanzas viste una chavala llamada Lenciú.
Yo vi de sensombre, amigo, una estrella dulce en el cañaveral, saeta de mil colores entre los rumores del pajonal.
Entré en el hueco de su guitarra, el lucero limpio de su corazón. Se fue río arriba para la sabana, como un hilo de agua serenito. Dice Martiniano que en la montaña, revolucionario todo es allí. Que anda clandestina una mariposa, y su responsable es un colebrí. Que anda clandestina una mariposa, y su responsable es un colebrí.
All right, all right. All right, we're back. I'm Randy Credico. This is Randy Credico Live on the Fly, and we are now joined by Medea. Welcome back to the show. It's been so long, Medea.
Hey, nice to be on with you, Randy.
You know that tune? Do you remember that tune?
I do, yes.
Yes. What, did you spend time in Central America in the 80s? I didn't meet you until like the late 90s.
Yeah, I spent time in Honduras. I wrote a book about a campesina activist. It's called Don't Be Afraid, Gringo. I spent time in El Salvador, some in Guatemala, less time in Nicaragua, but I was there. And I certainly worked here in the U.S.
Yeah.
Around the horrible U.S. policies toward Central America during that decade.
You know, actually, and because it ties into what I'm going to talk with you about, it was a pretty robust anti-intervention movement that took place back in the 80s. There were demonstrations everywhere. There were a lot of different groups. I actually did my act down in front of the U.S. Embassy every Thursday. There was a vigil Thursday morning at 7 a.m. in Managua in front of the U.S. Embassy. It was my best crowd ever, was that audience that would show up at 7 o'clock in the morning while I was suffering from a major hangover from drinking unfermented white rum or clear rum, whatever it was called. we did that a lot.
Remember, there was also a big sanctuary movement. And
yes.
So the churches were involved. A lot of people from the religious community were active during those years. We even had Congress people who were with us.
It was amazing. There was a lot of Congress. Christopher Dodd, I knew, was involved in that movement back then. He got a little more conservative later. But there were a lot of – do you remember Charlie Clements? I used to travel with Charlie Clements, Dr. Charlie Clements, Witness to War, his book and documentary. We went around the country.
Yes, love Charlie. And he did fantastic work back then and then worked at the Unitarian Universalists.
Right.
And – made lots of contributions towards trying to change U.S. policy.
Yeah. We have 1986, we went, I met him in Managua with Abby Fields. So I met him at the Intercontinental Hotel restaurant. And when I came back, I traveled with him and Country Joe McDonald to various close congressional race districts. From South Dakota to California, and it was an interesting tour, except for I had to follow Hearts and Minds. I'd go on to try to do comedy after they played that documentary, Hearts and Minds, about the Vietnam War. And so it was a tough film to try to get laughs on to follow. That's all I can tell you.
Yeah, but you could always do Give Me an F.
Right. Well, he did that. And he also played a great version, and the band played Waltzing Matilda, Country Joe. And he really got mad at me because I used to smoke cigars, and he had just quit smoking cigarettes, and he had a tantrum a couple of times. At any rate, well, let me come. I wanted you on today to talk about this. It's a little controversial. I'm not going because I'm busy all week this week, or I'd be down there. This whole affair down there, I mean, it's almost a public spat between personalities. But I don't think that's a reason not to go. What's your feeling on the event that's taking place, Rage Against the Machine, War Machine? And briefly tell us what that means. It's not about a specific war. It's rage against U.S. policy. Is that it?
Well, it's really meant for the war in Ukraine, but the demands are broader than that. It starts out with no more money for Ukraine and negotiate a peace settlement. But then it gets broader, including disbanding NATO, de-escalate nuclear weapons, slash the Pentagon budget, and perhaps one that a lot of us will really enjoy is the demand to abolish the CIA.
Yes.
And then it's also about restoring civil liberties and freeing Julian Assange. And I know, you know, you are a major activists in that movement, and a lot of the Julian Assange people are behind this Rage Against the War Machine rally.
All right. Well, I'm totally in support of any efforts to try to put an end to the CIA freeing Julian Assange, ending the war in Ukraine. Negotiations must take place soon. Otherwise, we're all facing an existential threat. And cutting the military budget. So this would be like the first, major demonstration. There are others that have taken place in New York City that I know of. So how do you see this playing out from this point on?
Well, it's been super controversial. It's just torn groups apart. My own organization, Code Pink, has been torn apart by it. And some groups have refused to endorse because they don't like some of the speakers. It's a real mixed bag of speakers. You get ones that are identifiable on the left, like you have David Swanson from World Beyond War. You have Chris Hedges, the former Congresswoman Cynthia McKinney, former retired Colonel Anne Wright. I mean, those people are
solid,
part of the left anti-war movement.
Max Blumenthal.
Stein from the Green Party.
Yes.
But then you have a group of other folks that some of whom do not share the same values as folks on the left would. One of them is Jackson Hinkle, who is a host of a podcast called The Dive, and another independent journalist named Kim Iverson. We have Ron Paul, the great libertarian who for many, many years was a congressperson.
18 years.
Tulsi Gabbard, who's a mixed bag all in one person. Having
I tell you, you don't mince words.
On the war.
You don't mince words.
Terrible on a lot of other issues. And then you have Jimmy Dore, the comedian and commentator, YouTube personality. So it's a very, very mixed bag. And why it's caused so much controversy is that particularly, you know, it's really interesting, Randy. I don't hear anybody who would consider themselves who wouldn't identify as a leftist or a progressive. I don't see any of them dropping out because of the leftists on there. But I see it from the other way around, that people who are progressives, leftists, they see some of these people that are going to be speaking and they say, I don't want to be on the same stage. I don't want to support this. I don't want my organization to support it. You know, it's not the typical anti-war rally. It's a broader one. And one of the reasons is because there's a Democrat in the White House. And whenever you get a Democrat in the White House, it's hard to get the more Democrat-connected organizations to be part of this. There's also groups that, you know, very concerned about issues of race issues, gay rights, women's issues, and they don't like some of the speakers. So, yes, it's created a lot of uproar, but I would say the good thing about that, Randy, is that, one, people are talking about this. Two, groups that don't want to be associated with this are kind of, it's lit a fire under them to organize bigger rallies on their own. So there's one called for March 18th here in D.C., so I think as a result of it, there will be more activism in general.
Well, that's good. This, these are the coals that will get the fire burning, hopefully.
Yeah.
But, there's always been. You know, back in the 80s, there were groups in New York City that one was called USACA, U.S. Out of Central America, and there was another group, Anti-Central America Intervention Group, and they did not ever march together. I mean, you can go down to Argentina. I'm very close with the Madres de Plaza de Mayo, one of the groups, the one, Lindia Fundadora, the other one, the late Heavy Bonafini, the Association of the Madres de Plaza de Mayo, they don't even march together. They march apart every Thursday at 3:30 at the in front of the Pink House. So there's
a lot of those divisions are personality and tactic kinds of things. This division is whether you think it's good to form a left, right, and some and in between coalition, or whether folks on the left should be expanding their reach without going into other ideologies. For example, there are people on the left who say, we haven't done enough to bring in the environmentalists. We haven't done enough to bring in the faith base. We haven't done enough to bring in the labor folks. And so let's put our energies there. And then others who say, no, we'll never make change with this Congress that we have unless we have a broad spectrum of people with different ideological bents. And so that's kind of the dividing line. There are other people, I should say, who don't feel comfortable with some of the speakers who seem too pro-Russian. So that's also been an issue. A lot of us are very quick to make it clear that we condemn the invasion and all the suffering that it's brought on, and we also condemn the U.S. provocations and want to see the U.S. make a push for the negotiation now. That would be my position.
Right.
But there are others who are speaking who really tend to justify what Russia has been doing, and that makes others uncomfortable.
Well, you're not going to like my next guest, probably, but he'll give you a different point of view. But, you know, I've been accused of being a Russophile because I've had this gentleman on. And, you know, the Russian position has not been presented by media in this country fairly at all from the very beginning. It's all been one-sided. How do you see it?
Absolutely. And I think it's great that you have him on. I think it's so important for people to hear from the Russian side that they're not a bunch of crazy animals, that they have real grievances that are legitimate, and they have security interests that are legitimate as well. So it is very important to hear the other side. And you can never think of where the possible solutions lie unless you hear the positions of all sides. And we certainly know that our media has not only censored the Russian side, closed off things like RT, which used to be called Russia Today, but also refused to print the op-eds of people like us who call for peace talks, refused to have people on the cable shows that are advocating for negotiations now. So we've had our own kind of censorship in this country, and that has led to the American people waving these Ukrainian flags and cheering on as we send in each new weapon system that only kills more Ukrainians, prolongs the war, and might lead us into a nuclear war.
Well, I tell you, you are just the perfect guest to have on today. You've described it all perfectly and poetically. Let's get back to your position. You're going to be there, but you're not speaking on Sunday, but you are going to be there. And you pretty much endorse this rally, right?
Yes, I'm delighted that this rally is happening. My organization, Code Pink, asked me not to speak, so I took my name off out of respect for my colleagues. But I will be there cheering on the rally, so cheering on those speakers that I like. Maybe I'll boo a couple of the other ones. But I am also organizing a lobby day. We would have done it on Monday, except it's a holiday, so we're doing it on Tuesday, marking 1 year of this horrible war, by going into Congress and asking anybody who can to join us. I know there's even people coming down from New York to join us for the lobby day. And we're going to be having some fun, Randy. We're going to go into the offices of the Speaker, Kevin McCarthy, and the Minority Leader, Hakeem Jeffries, and we're going to do a teach-in in their offices on the war for their staff. And then we're going to divide up and visit our own representatives, as well as trying to visit every member of the Armed Services Committee, because they're going to be now probably pushing to send fighter jets to Ukraine. So we want to get in there and say no to that and ask them to publicly speak out in favor of negotiations. We're also asking them to hold hearings on the blowing up of the Nord Stream pipeline, and asking them to send a delegation to Biden to ask him what he is doing to end this war. So that's what will be happening on Tuesday.
Tuesday. Now, how would people, if they want to go down there on Tuesday, they know about the rally. That's Sunday. What time is it Sunday? I don't have the...
Sunday at 12:30 at the Lincoln Memorial. And then Tuesday, just meet us at 9:30 in the morning at the Rayburn Cafeteria. The Rayburn office building is the big house office building. And if you can't get there at 9:30, we'll have somebody down there with a sign on the table all day long from 9:30 to 5, so you can come anytime.
Well, I'd like to be at both events, but it's going to be difficult. We'll see what I can do to make at least one of the events. But that
well,
Tuesday,
we will miss you. But and you know, Randy, there's going to be an after party at the Tabard Inn.
When?
Your favorite D.C. location.
Yes. We missed you when we paid tribute to the late Fritzy Cohen.
I heard it was great.
Yeah. We had some of your associates from Code Pink, your co-founder of Code Pink. Now, is it Code Pink that is sponsoring this event on Tuesday?
Well, it's nobody. It's me and retired Colonel Ann Wright. We are the organizers, so it's anybody who wants to. We don't want to have to brand it. It's open to all.
It is. All right. What else can we talk about? We're waiting for Dmitry Polyansky to call, and he's somewhere. I don't know exactly where, but I think that's maybe he's... Well, I'm going to keep talking with you for a few more minutes. How's this? How do people access your latest book?
Oh, they can get it on at the publisher's website, which is OR, just the letters OR, books, or they can get it at Code Pink. And, of course, if you want to go to that bad company, Amazon, you can certainly get it there. And it's in a lot of bookstores. I've been excited traveling around the country. I just got back from a book tour in a... dangerous place. I don't know why I said dangerous. I was trying to get across ironically that it was a hardship location, but that was Hawaii. I did a week book tour in the islands in Hawaii, and Barnes & Noble was carrying the book.
Well, that's great. That's great. They should get all your books.
It's getting out there. And we're delighted that they keep doing new reprinting because it's been selling very well.
That's fantastic. I really want to thank you for all that you've done and all that you continue to do. I wish there were people with your energy and your commitment to peace and social justice and racial justice and justice in general and the ending of war. So Sunday, who knows? Maybe I'll see you in front of the Lincoln Memorial at 12:30 p.m. In front of at 12:30 p.m. in front of Lincoln Memorial. And there'll be a march afterwards. And then Tuesday, lobby day in Congress to try to put an end to this existential threat that's happening. So we're going to say goodbye to you. Thank you so much. And continue.
Okay, great to be on with Randy. I look forward to seeing you either this weekend or sometime in the near future.
Okay, we're going to play. Thank you. That was Medea Benjamin. We're going to take a short break. We're going to listen to some Dmitry and then talk to a different Dmitry. Dmitry Shostakovich. I'm Randy Cretico. This is Randy Cretico live on the fly here at 99.5 FM in New York City, WBAI, and you can stream it at wbai.org. We are now being joined by Ambassador different Dmitry, Dmitry Polyansky. Welcome back to the show, Ambassador.
Yes. Hello, Randy. How do you hear me?
I think I can. Can we hear him okay?
Yeah.
I can hear you.
Great.
All right.
Great.
This is much better than the last time where we had someone putting frog voices on the line.
I don't know. I don't know. Well, I'll keep fingers crossed that they will not interfere.
Yes. Someone's going to try to interfere. All right. So, Dmitry Shostakovich. Now, when I look up his name, it's got an I at the end. And Dmitry Polyansky has a Y. Are those two different names?
Well, Shostakovich, I think, sounds rather Belarusian. Polyansky, well, maybe Russian, maybe Polish. It's very difficult because our nation is a combination of different peoples. Sometimes you would have, like my boss here, Ambassador Nebenzia, he has a Ukrainian name, but he identifies himself as Russian. So it's very mixed, you know?
Yeah, right. But that's a beautiful piece of music and an example of what people are missing in this country that have been overwhelmed, have been zapped with this anti-Russia mentality by our leaders and by our media. The cultural history of Russia is so beautiful, literature-wise and music-wise. And it must be frustrating for you, for all of this cultural past to be almost like you know, just doxed out of the record.
Yeah, that's not only frustrated. I would say that's ridiculous because this is part of world culture. So you can't say Tchaikovsky, to whom does it belong? Does he belong? Does he belong to Russia today? Does he belong to the world? It's common heritage. And, you know, displaying your feelings, your Russophobia in such a way as to canceling Russia, to banning everything Russian, this is ridiculous. And this is, of course, making the nation that behaves in such a way much poorer and deprive it of a lot of important things. It's very difficult to really understand what's the reasoning behind that.
Well,
no rational explanation.
I mean, how people need to read War and Peace and then watch the 6-hour Russian-made, it's back to Soviet Union, I think in the 50s. It's a 6-hour film on War and Peace that it's the most brilliant movie I've ever seen. Well, who was the director of that?
I don't remember right now. There are several versions of War and Peace now. There are more modern versions as well. The version that you are referring to, I think it is being referred to the 50s or the 60s. So we have now more modern ones, and actually the modern Russian culture is virtually unknown to Americans and to Europeans. We have a lot of good films, we have a lot of good composers, pieces of music, popular music, but if you ask a rank-and-file American of what do you think about modern Russian culture, I don't think that they will...
They don't know. They have absolutely no idea. Listen,
yeah.
I don't know that well because I can't get any of it. I have to look online to try to find it. It's all, been blacked out. And there's no talk about it. I mean, it's just...
It's like a blockade.
Yeah. So they want to think that the Russians are, you know, like cavemen or something. Look, I saw you at the UN last week, and people need to start talking with one another. And you have a great sense of humor. That was a wonderful thing, by the way, last week that I saw Roger Waters speaking in front of the Security Council. What's the feedback been? Not just that, but are you surprised that there was a lack of U.S. media coverage of that very important historic presentation?
I think there was media coverage, but of course not by the mainstream media.
Right.
I saw a lot of reporting on websites, on media sources. But the mainstream media, I think they have got the comment that they shouldn't report about it. They should put it into the shadow. It was a big reaction in Russia. I think a lot of people listened to Roger, and his speech was warmly welcomed by most of whom I had the chance to exchange with. We understand that he has his own views. We might not share 100% what he is saying, but what's important is the message, the peaceful message, the message of a person who had been fighting for peace, promoting peace for decades, and he understands now that the world is now on a very dangerous crossroads, and he wants the elite to act, the Western elite, to act in the way it should really act, facing such a danger, which is not being shared by a big part of the population.
Right. You know, I'm not going to take a cheap shot, but the ambassador, I think he was the ambassador from Ukraine, really took some cheap shots, underhanded shots, was very undiplomatic in his attacks of Roger in his remarks at the end of the presentation. I don't know if you want to comment on that, but I was pretty much appalled, and I know Roger was sitting there shaking his head that this guy was making all of these untoward accusations unfair and untrue accusations. So rather than just respond to what he said, why didn't he just respond to what was it about what Roger said that bothered him so much?
Well, his presence, first of all, bothered him so much. The fact that such a renowned personality was raising his voice against arms deliveries to the zone of conflict, of course, irritated him, because the Ukrainian leadership presents right now, arms deliveries are a lifeline for Ukraine, allegedly. So they think that, and the head of NATO is claiming that the only chance to support peace is to increase arms deliveries to Ukraine. Of course, Roger was not speaking within this ridiculous framework, and that irritated our Ukrainian colleague. Well, I don't want to comment on him personally. He's a very strange personality. Usually diplomats are very polite, and they try to behave. But the traditions of modern Ukrainian diplomacy are very different. You can recall very scandalous statements by Ukrainian ambassadors in different parts of the world, like former ambassador to Germany, who was insulting the German leadership, and ambassador in Kazakhstan, who was saying that all the Russians should get rid of this country, and so on and so forth. So they are behaving in a very cheeky, provoking way, and this guy also tries to provoke us in the Security Council. Today we had a meeting, for example, and he was again attacking personally my boss, Vasily Nebenzia, trying to provoke our response, our reaction, and to engage in kind of a heated exchange. But again, we have nerves. We understand that we are diplomats. We are there representing our country, and we understand that people will judge also our country by our behavior and by our restraint in the council.
You know, one of the points that I think you made, that if Roger were in Moscow, he would not be under any threat. But if he were in Kiev, he's on that hit list. I want you to remind people of that hit list. I know you talked about it the last time, but can you just, recapitulate the origins of this hit list and who's on it?
Yeah. Thank you for this opportunity. Well, this hit list appeared at the same time when there was this anti-constitutional Maidan coup in Ukraine in 2014. It was a list which was originally promoted by the Ministry of Interior of Ukraine, and I think for several years there was a logo of the Ministry of Interior of Ukraine on this page. This list is made by Ukrainian patriots, let's put it this way, so-called Ukrainian patriots, who can report anyone who they think by his or her behavior is threatening the interests of Ukraine or is an enemy of Ukraine. The reasons can be different. For example, someone learned that another person went to Crimea for vacation. And, of course, he did it through Russia because Crimea is a part of Russia, in our understanding. And then somebody would put him on hit list because this or that person would just cross without consent of Ukrainian authorities. But many people there, including myself, I'm also on this hit list, are being commented like, yeah, I'm on the hit list. My boss is on the hit list. So we are being there for being enemies of Ukraine, and every our public opinion appearance, and I think that maybe my interview at your radio will also be added to my profile at the Smiratvorets, would say that I am doing something against Ukraine. So this hit list was immediately launched after the Maidan coup, and this is not a child game, I would say, because there are a lot of personalities who were killed or maimed or targeted or assaulted because of this hit list. In 2014 or 15, I don't remember exactly, for example, a very prominent Ukrainian thinker, Mr. Alesya Buzina, was killed, and all the details of his personal life were on this hit list before, so his phone, his usual route from work to home. He was stalked, and he was followed, and he was assaulted several times, and then he was killed. It was a very famous case, notorious case, but nobody did anything about this. Then there were some other personalities killed. Recently, there was also a young philosopher, a young activist, Daria Dugina. She was killed last year, and she was also on this hit list, and some of her personal details were on the hit list. And what is also very appalling is that there are minors on this hit list, and we discovered in Russia, our NGOs discovered that there are about 330 minors who are there for different reasons. For example, very famous child writer from Donbass, Faina Savinkova. She's 14 right now, and when she was 12, she was added to this hit list only because she made an appeal to the Security Council. It was absolutely non-political appeal. It was not about Russia is good, Ukraine is bad. It was just appeal from a child. It was International Children's Day, and she was saying that the children of Donbass want peace, and please, guys in the Security Council, don't forget about the fact that there is a war in Donbass. That's it. And for that, this child was included in the hit list, and now there was some kind of outcry, international outcry about this. But UN authorities like UNICEF, like Secretary General, they tried to duck responsibility for this. They don't want to press Ukrainian authorities. And by the way, this, as far as we know, the servers of this hit list are in America, in the United States. So it's in the U.S. hands to stop this practice of doxing minors online. I don't think that if it happened with the assistance of U.S. authorities, if somebody tried to dox minors online, I don't think it would be possible in the U.S. But if Ukraine does this, it's okay. U.S. is closing the eyes, regardless of the fact that the server is on U.S. territory.
Are they doing this with the wink and the nod of the I don't even want to call him president. I don't even know what he is. I mean, I guess he's the puppet leader at this time, Zelensky. That comment in and of itself will probably get me on the hit list. But, Roger Waters is on the hit list. I think Max Blumenthal is on the hit list. A friend of mine, Alex Carlin, who I just had coffee with last week, who lives in Russia. He's an American that lives in Russia. He's a singer, and he plays in different different bars and nightclubs in Moscow. And I mean, I'm going to have him on next week. He says things are thriving there. People are going to nightclubs and everything. And I guess that got him on a hit list. So we're going to talk about that with him next week. Mm-hmm. But I just don't understand. That's the question. Does Zelensky know about this, or the parliament, the leadership of Ukraine know that this hit list exists, and are they allowing it to go on? Couldn't they put a stop to it? Because it's really bad PR.
You know, they changed the tactics. I think roughly at the moment when there was this information about Faina, they were boasting about it. So as I told you, there was a logo of Ukrainian Ministry of Interior, and one of his very notorious assistants of the minister, Mr. Gerashenko, was behind this hit list, and he was boasting it openly. Then at some point of time, they took away this logo, and they claimed that they have nothing to do, that this is just, you know, public initiative. So it's kind of an elephant in the room. Of course, everybody understands in Ukraine that the authorities are welcoming this work, that they are behind it. But now they are not formally associated, so they are in the shadows.
I see.
It's
right.
Like this.
Well, let's go back to Roger Waters' speech that day, that morning. And he had no idea that it had happened. But the explosive story by Seymour Hersh, who I've spoken to a couple of times in the last mm-hmm. few days, and he was interviewed today by Joe Loria on Consortium News for an hour. But that story came out that morning, so there wasn't even enough time for him. And I know he spent a day or two to write that beautiful overall philosophical, even though I know there were some issues there or some of the things he may have said that you might not disagree with. But so it was too late for him to incorporate that into that speech, you know. But and I figured by the end of the day, that story would be the biggest story in America. It was the most important story. And that, of course, is the U.S. Taking out the Nord Stream. How is that? How do you look at that and the media's coverage of it and the U.S. Deniability or denying that they had any complicity or were the orchestrators of this event?
Well, this is ridiculous. It looks ridiculous. It's an open secret. Everybody understands this. There are so many threats at the initial stage before this terrorist attack was committed, this sabotage. Threats from U.S. officials, from Biden to the others, Victoria Nuland, after that rejoicing this fact, and former Polish Foreign Minister Sikorski thanking USA Online in Twitter for this. So, of course, this is proven, or if you can say there is no other plausible explanation.
Right.
I remember when there was this Skripal hoax in the UK almost 5 years ago, when they tried to prove that Russia has any relation to this, then they used such things like highly likely, very, very likely, there is no other plausible explanations, and so on and so forth. So I can tell you if by grade from 8, from 1 to 10, if that was one, doubts of Russia, I mean, not the doubts, but the reasons to believe that Russia is involved. So this is 9, I would say, or maybe 9.5. Because 9.5. And of course, Mrs. Hersh's study shows that, gives us detail and insights on how it was done. And we understand why it was done. Now we know how it was done. Who were the accomplices? When was it committed? So there are so many proofs. It's even better than a smoking gun. I don't know what other proofs can be there. And we know, of course, that the U.S. administration has a long history of denying things and then confirming it, saying that, oh, guys, you know, that was really true. Starting from, I don't know, what strikes my mind. Like
I can tell you one. I'll tell you one.
Security Council, yeah.
I want you to continue, but I just want to just bring up one before I forget. The mining of the harbors in Nicaragua back in the 80s. The CIA mined the harbors, and they denied it. But then and they denied that they were supporting the Contras until Eugene Hasenfuss was shot down. But they denied all of it. Then, of course, they couldn't deny it when, proof came out, you know, video proof of all of it. But they deny this. And also, it's not just the U.S., but the Norwegians are complicit in this affair. Now, how do you respond to that?
Well, first of all, of course, there is a big indignation, I think, in the world, and we feel it. Even with the elites in Western countries, they try to be very obedient to the United States and to come to heel when it's necessary, when the master calls them. But, of course, in the public circles, there is a big indignation about this. So we are insisting on international investigation in this regard. First, we made two steps. First, we asked for Security Council meeting, which is due to take place early next week, most likely Wednesday afternoon. We still have hopes that Mr. Kirsch will find some time and come to brief the council, but we are looking into some other options as well. But another thing is that we, and that I think that this is something that I can reveal today, several hours ago, we introduced a draft Security Council resolution on the establishment of International Commission on the inquiry of sabotage of Nord Stream. So we want international involvement. We see that the authorities of several countries that are doing this investigation are not making the work to reveal the facts, but rather to conceal the facts, because Russia is not invited. Our authorities from Gazprom are not invited. We are being kept absolutely in away from the results of investigation, though there are very many smoking guns like the ones that I referred to already. So we want serious international investigation. We think that this can have serious consequences if we start to behave in such way in the world, attacking critical infrastructure and transnational pipelines, whatever. I don't know. So you can imagine what kind of chaos it can bring to the world. But these guys feel unpunishable. They feel that they are above the law, and they openly boast that they did it, that they like the consequences of this, and they are keeping some other countries in the muzzle, not allowing them to open their mouths and to say true facts about what happened to Nord Stream. Of course, this is ridiculous, and everyone sees this.
It's so obvious, you know what I mean, what happened. And I think you referred to my good friend, Craig Murray, who was able to debunk and laugh at and mock this allegation that this poison Novichok. There was absolutely no motivation for Russia to go in Salisbury and do that, but they just kept pushing it as if it was true. That must have been a real big headache to have this constantly thrown in your face when the whole thing was a fairy tale.
Absolutely. You know, I remember because I was there at that moment in the Security Council when they brought this question, this issue to us. And we were really believing that it will be very quickly proven that we have nothing to do with this, because the fact did not match. And we presented a lot of facts showing that we have nothing to do with this. We tried to appeal to the logic. You're absolutely right. So what was the reason for us to do it in such a weird and sophisticated way? If we theoretically could do away with Mr. Skripal, well, while he was 8 years in Russia, and there are a lot of other ways to end people's lives if you read criminal novels and so on. And there are so many inconsistencies in the alleged claims, alleged facts that the British side presented on Skripal. They didn't match, starting from the fact that they couldn't explain how really these alleged perpetrators, Petrov and Bashirov, they called it this way, how they brought this substance on the plane, because in this case, the whole plane would have been contaminated and they themselves would be contaminated. And ending in the situation when even according to the official timeline, we know that the most credible version is that Skripals were poisoned by some substance on their doorknob when they left their house. But the British side hasn't proven that Petrov and Bashirov were able to come to their house in Salisbury before they actually left the house. So it means that they physically couldn't have been in touch with the substance if Petrov and Bashirov tried to put it on the doorknob. So there were so many loopholes like this, so many inconsistencies. And you know what the British did at the end? That they always do. When we started asking them questions, when we started to summon them to Security Council, then they made a very, very predictable move. They say it's classified. They say it's top secret, and that investigation is top secret, and they will not reveal any more details. They did the same thing with Litvinenko before. We still have a lot of questions on this investigation. This is a policy of stockpiling lies, you know, of saying that Russia did it, and then without debunking most of the people who read some headlines, they would have the impression that Russia is behind this. And nobody is explaining the details. Nobody is looking for the facts. They just stockpiling the lies, and this is kind of a post-truth world that we are living right now. It's not important whether it actually happened. It's important how it is being presented in mass media and how the people are brainwashed afterwards to believe in it.
Well, it's all part of this campaign to demonize Russia. I guess they were laying the groundwork, and they have been, for the public not to like Russia. They did it for a couple of years, it seemed like. That's all they talked about was this Russiagate, crazy theory that Russia hacked and they gave it to this person. Yeah. And that must have been to see that on a regular basis must have been very annoying for you.
It's enough to imagine this whole hoax about our alleged meddling in U.S. elections. So what has come out of this?
Nothing.
Again, nobody has provided any explanation to anybody, and nobody has excused presented us excuses for this. So saying that guys were sorry, you were wrongly accused of this. Nobody's caring. You remember this famous story about Russia allegedly paying bounty to Taliban. It was on papers. Everybody was also shouting on Russia, threatening Russia. Then everybody, now we know that there is nothing behind this. And I think that the Americans themselves recognize that there is nothing behind this. But you can still find in some of the logical chains, in some publications, that this is also something that Russia has in fact did. By the way, there was such a fuss about Russia allegedly paying Taliban, and now U.S. is paying our neighbors and giving them arms, and nobody is caring about this. So they absolutely don't think how we perceive this situation and how it is perceived in the world and what kind of reputation the United States has because of such actions.
Is the U.S. paying the salaries of the Ukrainian military? This is something
I don't know such details, but there were a lot of reports saying that there are U.S. Personnel there, and even long before the beginning of our special military operation, there were U.S. Specialists in the ministries, U.S. counselors, U.S. advisors, and they were actually running the country already at this point. I can imagine that now it is even more true than before that.
You see any light, Ambassador, at the end of the tunnel here, going forward, because this seems like it's just, I mean, today, not inviting Russia to participate in this Munich defense or security conference, that was a real insult. What was your response to that?
Well, this is a conference. We are polite people. If you are not invited to a conference, we're not begging for this, but this devaluates the conference itself. How can you speak about European or world security without Russia? That's the problem that now, and we spoke about this today at the meeting in our speech, that The Europeans are so poisoned by Russophobia today that they are thinking about European security architecture against Russia. But they should still think, of course, about European security architecture with Russia. And that's something that we were proposing for tens of years, I would say, recently. And now this not invitation to this conference of Russia, this, of course, also reflects the fact that the West now wants to create some kind of group of interest, like-minded countries that rule the world, and they want to get rid of Russia and China and all the others who are saying nasty things to them and who are criticizing their domination of the world. So this is called rules-based international order, and we ask not to confuse it with international law, which is embodied in the UN Charter. So this rules-based international order foresees that the rules are formulated by a group of countries, U.S. and its allies, and everybody else should obey to these rules. If you do not agree to this, then you are enemy to the humanity. That's how they promote international relations. So Munich, the conference, has become this gathering of the group of like-minded countries without any opposition, without any other views. As far as I heard, Iran is also not invited, so I can't imagine how you can discuss Middle Eastern security without Iran. So this has boiled down to some very ridiculous scenarios when people really don't want to hear another opinion. That's how I see it.
Yeah, they let Zelensky speak, and it was a very rough speech.
Zelensky's speaking everywhere. Zelensky's trying to raise his voice everywhere. He's speaking at film festivals, at song contests in Italy, in San Remo, which is, I think, also irritating a little bit to people. But it's not serious, you know. What is he saying? Russia is our enemy. Give us more arms. Give us more money.
That's all Zelensky he says.
Had the chance. Yeah, Zelensky has the chance to come to the UN and to speak to us. We were opposing him speaking through video link because this is a violation of rules of procedure of Security Council, but Western countries were, because they are numerous in Security Council, they imposed this rule for him to come. So he spoke on video several times, and we were always saying that we would welcome President Zelensky if he comes in person, if he shows respect to the Security Council. But he didn't. And do you remember when he really appeared in the U.S., when it was time to beg for more weapons in the Congress?
Right, you mean from the Congress.
Yeah. And he didn't even think of appearing before Security Council or before General Assembly.
Well, he was right there. It would have been easy.
Yeah, well, it would have been easy, but of course it's not his priority. His priority is to beg for more weapons, to sustain his regime, and to make more Ukrainians being used as cannon fodder at this absolutely unnecessary campaign that they are waging. So that's his priority. He doesn't want to speak in person. He just wants to address through video, other things. He wants to address film festivals, to mobilize support in this way. But it's not about serious things. It's not about serious conversation. His ambassador to the UN reflects the real state of Ukrainian diplomacy right now. I think it's very illustrative.
Well, I invite him on this show because I have some tough questions for him. Do you think he'll show up? He can actually come into the studio. I'll ask him if he'd like to come in here, and I have some tough questions for him. He better sit down and negotiate because the world is at stake. I appreciate having you on. We are at the end of the show. There are a lot more questions. We will have you back on soon, and hopefully you will be able to do it and answer some of the other questions and keep us updated on what's happening at the UN. Thank you. Mr. Polyansky, ambassador.
To you and to all the listeners of your radio. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Whatever you have, Reggie, that was a fascinating interview. And only at WBAI can we have this kind of discussion. Remember, on Sunday, there's a demonstration, Rage Against the War Machine, 12:30 at the Lincoln Memorial, and then Tuesday. Do we have any time to play any outgoing music here? All right, we're going to go now. Thank you, Reggie, and thank you all out there. And here's Mercedes Sosa.
is WBAI New York, 99.5 FM and WBAI.org online. The previous program was Live on the Fly with Randy Credico, and that conversation that you just heard with Randy is one of the reasons, one of the main reasons why a radio station like WBAI should exist. So if you appreciate the efforts of what Randy have done and has been doing for so long, please consider becoming a financial supporter to this radio station by calling 212-209-2950 or go to give to WBAI.org online. That's 212-209-2950 or go to give to